Determinism. Determinism has a twofold character. On the one hand, it is a practical maxim for the guidance of scientific investigators. On the other hand, it is a general doctrine as to the nature of the universe. The practical maxim may be sound, even if the general doctrine is uncertain. Let us begin with the maxim and proceed afterwards to the doctrine. The maxim advises people to seek causal laws, that is to say, rules connecting events at one time with events at another. In everyday life, we guide our conduct by rules of this sort, but the rules that we use purchase simplicity at the expense of accuracy. Such rules will not do for science, which wants something invariable. Its ideal was fixed by Newtonian astronomy, where, by means of the law of gravitation, the past and future positions of the planets can be calculated throughout periods of indefinite vastness. The search for laws governing phenomena has been more difficult elsewhere than in relation to the orbits of the planets, because elsewhere there is a greater complexity of causes of different kinds, and a smaller degree of regularity of periodic recurrence. Nevertheless, causal laws have been discovered in chemistry, in electromagnetism, in biology, and even in economics. The discovery of causal laws is the essence of science, and therefore there can be no doubt that scientists do right to look for them. If there is any region where there are no causal laws, that region is inaccessible to science. But the maxim that scientists should seek causal laws is as obvious as the maxim that mushroom gatherers should seek mushrooms. Determinism, as a general doctrine, asserts that complete determinism of the future by the past is always possible, theoretically, if we know enough about the past and about causal laws. The investigator, observing some phenomenon, should, according to this principle, be able to find previous circumstances and causal laws which together made the phenomenon inevitable. And, having discovered the laws, he should be able, when he observes similar circumstances, to infer that a similar phenomenon is going to occur. An omniscient God, such as the Orthodox believe in, must now know the whole course of the future. There is, therefore, if an omniscient God exists, a present fact, namely, his foreknowledge, from which the future could be inferred. This, however, lies outside what can be scientifically tested. If this doctrine of determinism is to assert anything that can be made probable or improbable by evidence, it must be stated in relation to our human powers. If we are to have a doctrine that can be tested, it is not enough to say that the whole course of nature must be determined by causal laws. This might be true, and yet undiscoverable. For example, if what is more distant had more effect than what is nearer, for we should then need a detailed knowledge of the most distant stars before we could foresee what was going to happen on Earth. If we are to be able to test our doctrine, we must be able to state it in relation to a finite part of the universe, and the laws must be sufficiently simple for us to be able to make calculations by their means. We cannot know the whole universe, and we cannot test laws which are so complicated as to require more skill than we can hope to possess for the working out of their consequences. The powers of calculation involved may exceed what is possible at the moment, but not what may probably be acquired before long. This point is fairly obvious, but there is more difficulty in stating our principle so as to be applicable when our data are confined to a finite part of the universe. Things from outside may always crash in and have unexpected effects. Sometimes a new star appears in the heavens, and these appearances cannot be predicted from the data confined to the solar system. And as nothing travels faster than light, there is no way by which we can get an advance message telling that a new star is going to appear. For the first time in history, determinism is now being challenged on scientific grounds. The challenge has come through the study of the atom by the new methods of quantum mechanics. According to quantum mechanics, it cannot be known what an atom will do in given circumstances. There are a definite set of alternatives open to it, and it chooses sometimes one, sometimes another. We know in what proportion of cases one choice will be made, in what proportion a second or a third, and so on. But we do not know any law determining the choice in an individual instance. No one can deny that laws may be discovered which will show why an atom chooses one possibility on one occasion and another on another. At present, we know of no relevant difference in the antecedents of the two different choices, but some such difference may be found any day. If we had any strong reason to believe in determinism, this argument would carry great weight. Unfortunately for the determinists, there is a further step in the modern doctrine of atomic caprice. We had, or so we thought, a great mass of evidence from ordinary physics tending to prove that bodies always move in accordance with laws which completely determine what they will do. It now appears that all these laws may be merely statistical. The atoms choose among possibilities in certain proportions, and they are so numerous that the result, as regards bodies large enough to be observed by old-fashioned methods, has an appearance of complete regularity. Suppose you were a giant who could not see individual people, and never became aware of an aggregate of less than a million of them. You would just be able to notice that London contains more matter by day than by night. But you could not possibly be aware of the fact that, on a given day, Mr. Dixon was ill in bed and did not take his usual train. You would therefore believe the movement of matter into London in the morning and out of it in the evening to be a much more regular affair than it is. You would no doubt attribute it to some peculiar force in the sun, a hypothesis which would be confirmed by the observation that the movement is retarded in foggy weather. If, later, you became able to observe individual people, you would find that there is less regularity than you had supposed. One day, Mr. Dixon is ill, and another, Mr. Simpson. The statistical average is not affected, and to a large-scale observation there is no difference. You would find that all the regularity you had previously observed could be accounted for by the statistical law of large numbers, without supposing that Mr. Dixon and Mr. Simpson had any reason beyond caprice for their occasional failure to go to London in the morning. This is exactly the situation at which physics has arrived in regard to atoms. It does not know of any laws completely determining their behaviour, and the statistical laws which it has discovered are sufficient to account for the observed regularity and the motions of large bodies. And as the case for determinism has rested on these, it seems to have broken down. What quantum theory assumes as regards individual atoms is a law of probability. Of the possible choices open to the atom, there is a known probability of one, another known probability of a second, and so on. From this law of probability, it can be inferred that large bodies are almost certain to behave as traditional mechanics expect. The observed regularity of large bodies, therefore, is only probable and approximate, and affords no inductive ground for expecting a perfect regularity in the doings of individual people. What is new in quantum mechanics is not the occurrence of statistical laws, but the suggestion that they are ultimate, instead of being derived from laws governing individual occurrences. This is a very difficult conception, more difficult, I think, than its supporters realize. It has been observed that, of the different things an atom may do, it does each a certain proportion of cases. But if the single atom is lawless, why should there be this regularity as regards large numbers? There must, one would suppose, be something that makes the rare transitions depend upon some unusual set of circumstances. Now, the laws of large-scale mechanics, as we have seen, are unchanged by the new theories as to the atom. The only difference is that they now state overwhelming probabilities instead of certainties. It is possible to imagine these probabilities counteracted by some peculiar kind of instability, owing to which a very small force might produce a very large effect. This sort of instability may exist in living matter, and more particularly in the brain, An act of volition may lead one atom to this choice rather than that, which may upset some very delicate balance, and so produce a large-scale result, such as saying one thing rather than another. It cannot be denied that this is abstractly possible, but that is the most that can be conceded. It is also a possibility, and to my mind a much more probable one, that new laws will be discovered which will abolish the supposed freedom of the atom. And even granting the freedom of the atom, there is no empirical evidence that large-scale movements of human bodies are exempt from the process of averaging, which makes traditional mechanics applicable to the movements of other bodies of appreciable size. The search for causal laws, as we saw, is the essence of science. And therefore, in a purely practical sense, the person of science must always assume determinism as a working hypothesis. But he is not bound to assert that there are causal laws except where he has actually found them. Indeed, he is unwise if he does so. But he is still more unwise if he asserts positively that he knows of a region where causal laws do not operate. This assertion has an unwisdom at once theoretical and practical. Theoretical, because our knowledge can never be sufficient to warrant such an assertion, and practical, because the belief that there are no causal laws in a certain province discourages investigation and may prevent laws from being discovered. This double unwisdom seems to me to belong both to those who assert that changes in atoms are not completely deterministic, and to those who dogmatically assert free will. Faced with such opposite dogmatisms, science should remain purely empirical, carrying neither assertion nor denial beyond the point warranted by actual evidence. Perennial controversies, such as that between determinism and free will, arise from the conflict of two strong but logically irreconcilable passions. Determinism has the advantage that power comes through the discovery of causal laws. Science, in spite of its conflict with theological prejudice, has been accepted because it gave power. Belief that the course of nature is regular also gives a sense of security. It enables us, up to a point, to foresee the future and to prevent unpleasant occurrences. When illness and storms were attributed to capricious diabolical agencies, they were much more terrifying than they are now. All these motives lead people to determinism. But while they like to have power over nature, they do not like nature to have power over them. If they are obliged to believe that before the human race existed, laws were at work which, by a kind of blind necessity, produced not only people in general, but oneself, with all one's idiosyncrasies, saying and doing at this moment whatever one is saying and doing. They feel robbed of personality, futile, unimportant, the slaves of circumstance, unable to vary in the slightest degree the part assigned to them by nature from the very beginning. From this dilemma, some people seek to escape by assuming freedom in human beings and determinism everywhere else. Others, by ingeniously sophisticated attempts at a logical reconciliation of freedom with determinism. In fact, we have no reason to adopt either alternative, but we also have no reason to suppose that the truth, whatever it may be, is such as to combine the agreeable features of both, or is in any degree determinable by relation to our desires.